in a medium that is less dense, and this is the dolphin. The dolphin is a mammal, and many millions of years ago it seems that dolphins were living on the land. But they are very clever, and they decided that the land was no place to live, because getting food was difficult, and you had to lug yourself around. And there were many, many bad shows about the land. It had very curious changes of temperature. It became unspeakably cold and unspeakably hot. And you had, in fact, to work. Well, no sensible person ever works. I never work. I get paid for playing. And everybody should do that. That's the mark of an educated man, is that eventually he gets a job where he's paid for playing. And a worker or a proletarian isn't necessarily a poor man. Lots of poor, I mean, a poor man like, say, Selig Morgenrath or Eric Barker around here, they're not proletarians. A proletarian is a person who is fettered to the process of work. That is to say, to doing chores every day that he really doesn't like and that aren't in the least interesting in order to go on living. So the dolphins decided this is ridiculous, this land existence, and they went back to the water. And it's pretty easy to fish, you see. There are plenty of fish in the water and things to eat. As we know, the ocean is the greatest food supply in the world. And when they'd eaten a few fish or whatever they need, they decided just to have a ball. So the dolphin can get abreast of a ship, get one of the wakes coming out on the side, can set its tail at an angle of 26 degrees, you know, and be pushed along by the ship. And it's not going anywhere. There's no reason to go along there. As you know, as if it had to get to another part of the sea's pretty much the same all through. But they're just going, boom, and they chatter and dance, and they're really highly civilized beings. And so, please don't anybody ever kill dolphins or be unkind to dolphins, because they're exemplary, high-minded creatures. And we shall soon discover this. As soon as we can set up communication with them, they will tell us all about it, and we will then invent new style of civilization based on frolic. But you see, they dance in the mode of water. Now, human beings, as Toynbee has pointed out, as their civilization progresses, they begin to lose their roots. And they are less and less tied to the land. They go into the air. And what's going to happen as if man develops without blowing himself to bits, if he can get over the hurdle, you see, that dangerous point, is that gradually all roads are going to disappear. And the earth will have centers of human habitation, you see, but no roads. They'll be as obsolete as railroad tracks, because everybody will fly. And once the medium of air is much more fluid than the medium of water, and as we fly, you see, on the land, your values are all values of permanence, solidity, firmness. They're architectonic in the sense of our great stone structures, pyramids, and things like that. But in the air and on the water, all values are fluid. And what you have to know to be a good airman is, of course, stars. Like white throats and other migrating birds migrate by the stars. Imagine. But once you start relating yourself to the stars, you realize that you're living in a universe where directions are all relative. And you become a being capable of existing in non-solidity. And that's why Buckminster Fuller, you know, believed that all techniques and really all culture came from the sea. The men who first learned to sail were the wise men. He has a fantastic idea that there were initiates, great priests who were ship's captains, and that although some of their humble seamen didn't know all the secrets, that these priests were the first people who knew that the world was round. And that that gives one an entirely different theology, you see, than if you believe that the world is flat. And so from the priests of the ocean, the landsmen learned how to use cranes, blocks and tackles, how to build, what a good house an overturned ship made. And so to this day, a cathedral has a nave as its central auditorium, nave from Latin navis, ship, showing the connections between ships and the first temples. And so Fuller goes on to say, now if you're a good architect, as the ancient architects learned from the ocean, first thing you should do when you get through architectural school is go and work in an airplane factory. And understand the beautiful thing that man has made in a fine, fine airplane, you see, which is as great as a bird in its own way. Because that's the architecture of insecurity. And that really lives with insecurity. Well, let's have an intermission.
Thanks for tuning into this program from Better Listen. Please visit betterlisten.com for more information about this program and the opportunity to share your comments and feedback with others. Listen presents Reality, Art, and Illusion, Part 4, with Alan Watts.
Just a short resume about this morning. I was discussing the various meanings of the word Maya, which in Sanskrit means illusion. Or at least that's the way it's generally translated. Now, I was trying to explain that it doesn't necessarily mean illusion in a bad sense. When we say a person is suffering from delusions, hallucinations, and so on, it's always a put-down word. But Maya is not so necessarily. So I showed you how it has the meanings of measurement, as when we pretend that the world is divisible actually into feet or inches or hours or seconds or degrees, and divide things from each other by these measurements, that is to say, by the cutting power of thought. Thought, from in the Latin scio, means to cut. And so thought is, you see, what you have to understand is that everything is really a think. A thing is a unit of thought in the same way as an inch is a unit of measurement. We divide the wiggly, continuous, wobbly, wild, Rorschach blot of the physical universe into things so that we can think about it. And one thinks by a process which is essentially the calculus. Calculate. Calculus, what was it originally? Using pebbles to count. So the word calculus means a pebble, originally. So I count, I remember something, 1, 2, 3, 4 times, 4 pebbles. Like using your fingers. Rosaries have been used for this purpose. And so later the abacus as a kind of amazing rosary. That's calculation, you see. Pretending that the world is a collection of bits. But the world isn't a collection of bits. The world is continuous in the sense that every bit of it is interrelated as much as a human body. You realize, you know, if you magnify the human body to an enormous degree so that you are looking at its individual molecules, one molecule of our body is the size of my fist, say, you know, magnified to that size, the next one would be the other side of the room. Now, what joins them together? I move my hand, all those vastly separated molecules all move together. They haven't any strings tied between them. And it's the same way when the little birds fly. In my boat in Sausalito, we have a lot of little tiny sandpipers. And they fly having one mind. They become a total organism when they fly. And they change direction instantly. I mean, it isn't that they turn like this and follow the leader. They're going like that, and then they go like that. And they're only individuals when they start pecking on the mud. Then they wander around all over the place and get it, but the slightest movement, pow! They're all in the air again and going as one mind. Now, that's how your molecules move in your hand. So calculus pretends that the molecules are separate. They're not. They're related to each other by the space between them. And space is relationship. Space is order. I remember this once, very vivid illustration. I had a friend who was giving a lecture, and she wanted to use her studio for the lecture. And she had some those canvas chairs that you pull open like that, and they have arms, canvas back, and canvas seat. You know, movie director's chairs. And she'd got them all lined up across the room, this way, zut, 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 zut. And she said, I can't possibly get all the people in here. I said, wait a minute, space is order. You say you don't have enough space, you do. So I put the speaker at that side of the room, and I arranged all the chairs round the wall like that, and coming across like that. Then the next row, then the next row, and the next row, and there were far more seats in there than they had before, you see? So space is order, and space is terribly important. But the Maya that I pointed out, you see, is that we ignore it. So Maya is measurement. Thinging, chopping things into bits so as to count them. Number two, Maya is play. That is to say, it's a game. It's hide and seek. The universe is playing peekaboo with itself. Now you see it, now you don't. And the basis of that is the throb of vibration. Up and then down, up and then down. It is male, female, positive, negative. Light, darkness, this side, that side. See? Everything is going, and it's going so fast that it seems to be continuous. But now you see it, now you don't. See? Solid space. Here and gone. Everything is that. See, if I put my hand on your knee and leave it there, you cease to remember I'm there. But if I do this, you know I'm there all the time. Because each time it's renewed. Okay? So, it's play. Maya is also magic. And I gave the illustration of the theater, of creating the illusion that the drama is reality. All the illusory possibilities of the theatrical art. Then I meant specifically, Maya is art. Maya is skill in creating something. And I showed how the artist can give us all kinds of different visions of the universe. From the vision of, let's say, Giotto, with its amazing transparency, to Rembrandt, with its density, to the great Flemish painters like Van Eyck, who begin a photographic realism, onto the similar painters of the 19th century, and then through Picasso, and so on, to splashers like Jackson Pollock, were all enabling us to see the world in different ways by their revelation. And so the possibilities of artistry are infinite. More and more artists will come and notice the world in different ways. And there are probably infinitely many ways in which the world can be noticed. Only the human mind works at a certain pace. It seems incapable of bringing more than a few at a time. It doesn't assimilate them. And then I discussed the final question. Does that mean that the world is nothing but our imagination? That is to say, going back to the analogy of the Rorschach blot, we say in testing a person on a Rorschach blot that he projects a story or a picture into the blot, and that reveals not something about the nature of the blot, but about the condition of his psychological structure. Are we going to have to say that in the same way, all scientific knowledge about the universe is a projection? You see, that's been very cogently argued. It's argued, for example, that laws of nature do not exist in nature, but are methods of measuring nature. In other words, to say that stones always fall downwards to the center of the earth, we invent for that the law of gravity. Now, is that a law? Is there something called the law of gravity which stones obey? Well, many scientists would say no. If the stone didn't fall to the ground, it would be a balloon. It obeys no law, it does that. And we make a law out of it simply because it happens regularly. If I regularly do what you tell me to, that becomes in human affairs a law. But nobody tells the stone that it's got to fall down. It just does so because that's part of the definition of being a stone. If it didn't, it'd be a balloon, you see? Or a feather in the wind. So laws of nature are regarded by some scientists as tools invented by human beings. And to say that there is a law of gravity is neither more nor less true than saying there are 3 feet in a yard, because we arranged it that way. Or there are 24 hours in a day. Laws are simply observed regularities. And we make these regularities by the way we look at things. We might not even notice that stones fell to the ground unless it was significant to us. But the difficulty of pushing that theory too far is that it makes the human mind ridiculously independent of the physical world. Say that everything is a projection out of the human mind would be to say that the human mind isn't really part of the world, but it is. Our being is continuous with the being of the whole universe, as I explained. Each one of us is something the whole universe is doing, just as every wave is something that the sea is doing. And well, we are waves of the universe, and it's waving and saying, "Yoo-hoo, I'm here." And I'm called Alan Watts right now. But it's called so-and-so all around the room, but it's all the same thing doing this jazz. And I explained how we have been taught to ignore that and to be under the illusion that we're all doing it separately. Now, that was what we were talking about this morning. Now, I want to press one aspect of this theme, particularly this afternoon, which is the aspect of play. The distinction, you see, the whole point is that a man who knows a woman, is it objectionable to you that we have to use man as the general word for human beings? Anyway, that the person who knows that this is Maya is, as I said, somewhat disconcerting because we know that he doesn't take life seriously. That is to say, he doesn't take it absolutely seriously. He takes it seriously up to a point. But as we might say, when it really comes down to it, he doesn't. Now, you might think that such a person would be extremely undependable. And therefore, he's ethically suspect. If he knows that all the distinctions between good and evil, and between life and death, between the valuable and the non-valuable, if he knows that all those distinctions are illusory, would he not be, we're afraid, a very dangerous person? Would he fail to keep his contracts? Would he steal when he felt like it? Would he bump somebody off when it suited his convenience, you see? Isn't it more trustworthy for human beings to believe that there are absolute laws, that it matters absolutely that you never kill anybody, etc.? Now, this is a very fascinating question. And I want to suggest to you, first of all, that a person who believes in absolute laws is liable to be quite dangerous. Because he puts rigid structures in a place of higher honor than, oh, such a good old word, but no longer used, inwit. INWIT.